I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, I'll be speaking with Los Angeles-based psychotherapist Elliot Rosenstock. Elliot is the senior editor of the Young Freudians magazine, an experimental philosophy and psychology journal dealing with ideas like psychodynamic therapy and ecotheory. He is also the author of an upcoming book from Zero Books entitled Zizek in the Clinic, A Revolutionary Proposal for a New Endgame in Psychotherapy. The following conversation with Elliot will return to some ground that we covered in episode 2 of the Parallax Views podcast on neo-reaction with Elizabeth Sandifer. In this conversation, Elliot and I delve into the topic of accelerationism, which Elizabeth and I briefly covered in our discussion of neo-reaction and the ideas of Nick Land. In addition, we also take a few divergences from the main topic to discuss Lacanian psychoanalysis, psychotherapy, and the ideas of Max Stirner and the egoist school of anarchism. I hope you enjoy my interview with Elliot Rosenstock. To get the ball rolling, before the interview, I'm going to play an excerpt from Nick Land's Meltdown as a bit of an apropos warm-up to the conversation. It'll get you in the right headspace, so to speak.
Winding road to the hog farm. A lot of the hog farmers were very enamored with his style. And I can see how he could mesmerize people. At one point, he really embedded in this meditation circle and started forming even the sound of the universe all together. Oh, you know, like that. And in the middle of this home circle, which is quite beautiful, actually, his wives are leaning out saying, stop, 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 move away, stop going. And Charlie stopped choking and leaped out of the window of the bus and ran square on and mid-delivery of this scream put back in my entire scene. And I don't know where he came from at this point. And you rise up beyond yourself somehow. You lift him into some
Renaissance rationalization and oceanic navigation. Lock and put on modulation takeoff. Logistically accelerating techno-economic interactivity. Crumbled social order and auto-sufficiency. sophisticated machine runway. Head markets learn to manufacture intelligence. Politics modernizes, upgrades their loyal, and tries to get a grip, The body count climbs through a series of globe wars. Emergent planetary commercium thrashes the Holy Roman Empire. The Napoleonic continental system, the Second and Third Reichs, and the Soviet International, ranking of mind disorder through two pressing phases. Deregulation and the state, arms race each other into hybrid. By the time soft engineering slithers out of its box and into yours, new insecurity is urgency into crisis. Slowly, lateral genotype transfer, transversal replication, and cyber rot exploring the restoring lapse onto bacterial sex. Neo-China arrives from the future. Synthetic drugs built into digital weapons.
Take vigorous police activity
and always screw up viciously.
Schizonosis works
differently.
It avoids ideas and sticks to diagrams. Networking software
for accessing bodies without organs.
Terrestrial meltdown singularity. Phase-out culture accelerates upon its digitechnian adaptive landscape, passing through compression thresholds north to an intensive logistic curve. 1500, 1756, 1884, 1948, 1980, 1996, 2004, 2008, 2010, 2011, 1948, 1998, 1996, 2004, 2010, 2011.
Welcome to Parallax News, Elliot Rosenstock.
Thank you for having me.
So, I wanted to have you on because you're starting to gain somewhat of a name within the, you know, the left and the sort of egoist and anarchist circles. You're working with Dr. Bones now, and you have a book coming out from Zero Books, Zizek in the Clinic. But I wanted to talk to you about your interest in accelerationism and Nick Land. Why don't we start by sort of explaining what we mean by accelerationism?
I think there's a lot of different definitions of accelerationism. And I think for the purposes of, I guess, brevity, I'll tell you what I find interesting about accelerationism. One is the ability to operate sort of outside of a sort of macro system. Two, an ability to sort of get in touch with your sort of local community in a way that I think people lose when they try to reference, I guess, larger systemic, I guess, reference points. So, for instance, if you're trying to figure out what to do in your local community by watching Donald Trump and then sort of becoming reactionary to the actions of people like him and, I guess, the Democratic Party as a whole, you won't get as good of a sense of what it is, where it is you're actually existing. So in a way, I would say accelerationism is a policy of various, like left, I really like Nick Cernicek, and if I'm saying the name wrong, I apologize. I like him and I like his sort of ideal world, and I think it would be nice to live in Nick Cernicek's left acceleration world. For me, I think most of accelerationism I use as sort of a pragmatic way to live in the current world in a way that rehumanizes us, even though it does have this sort of anti-humanist, but anti-humanist doesn't mean unhuman, you know, or inhuman. I think by having a sort of grounding in your own sort of self-interest and sense of reality and what you care about, you can build a more human sort of experience. So that's accelerationism to me, and that's my interest in it, essentially.
Yeah, you mentioned Nick. I believe he wrote a book on the topic called Platform Capitalism, and I think he also co-authored the accelerationist manifesto with Alex Williams. But I think, isn't his version of accelerationism sort of different from the prior form that Nick Land sort of came up with?
Yeah, it's extremely different. And it's extremely different from mine as well. And I think what Nick talks a lot about is the sort of monopolization of technological communication by various platforms like Google sort of accumulates, Amazon accumulates, Facebook accumulates, and he really wants to do something about that. For me, I say, okay, yeah, I agree that this is bad. This is happening. So what do we do? What do we do in the meantime? What do people like me and you do about this sort of thing, who maybe don't have access to breaking up large monopolies such as Google or Facebook or Amazon or nationalizing them? Nick Cernicek is doing really good work and in helping people understand the sort of world we live in and the dangers of this sort of monopoly that is happening with these organizations, and I think he's charted it very well in Platform Capitalism, his book.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, the thing I got from Nick Cernicek, and I'm probably mispronouncing it too, actually, but the thing I got from Nick was that he's often said that when he says accelerationism, he doesn't mean what some people accuse, like Chris Cutrone from the Platypus Affiliated Society or Zizek of doing during the elections, where they were like, maybe you should pull the lever for Trump. Nick Cernusek sort of says that he's interested in accelerating changes in direction. I've heard him say that before, but.
Yeah. Well, it makes sense. One of the first times I came across him in sort of a forum, I asked him that very question. And I just sort of like as a half joke, sort of the Zizek. I'm also not in favor of supporting conservative candidates in order to create some sort of possible change, because I think that's an alchemist game, and it's essentially you're rolling the dice and you're probably going to lose. You're probably not going to get progressive reform by supporting conservative candidates. But I asked him as a joke. I was like, so does that mean we should support conservative parties? And he had a one-word response, which was no. So yeah, no, I'm with him on that. And I think I definitely operate on a microsystemic and possibly mesosystemic level, where I think Nick operates on a macro systemic level. And I think also I take from Nick Land a lot more than Nick Cernusek would. And I would say their various sort of strategies, which I think are useful for the left to look into. And I think left accelerationism doesn't do that, because these are sort of, I think they require a sort of a strategy which is different than the sort of general feeling of what the outcome should be. So it's like, you don't necessarily want to think of decentralized networks of people that are isolated and alienated and are sort of cut off from parts of the social order in order to produce a more, you know, human, more socially caring and empathetic community. It's almost counterintuitive. So I think it's a difficult leap for the left to make into seeing the value in the sort of patchwork system that the newer accelerationists and I think the right accelerationists are using for strategy, despite what ideology they're sort of pushing through that strategy. And I think Nick is, he doesn't want any part of that.
Right? Yeah. Okay.
Cernusek. Yeah, Cernusek.
We're going to get confused.
Nick Land, very much. He wants two helpings of that. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned the patchwork thing. I think that originates with Moldbug, and I've had a hard time wrapping my head around it. What is patchwork for like listeners that may be unfamiliar with this idea?
Well, I'll tell you a good example how say left communists can use patchwork. Say you're interested in starting an anarcho-communist movement or organization. Say you get 30 people, you're able to create some sort of communal economy in some sort of way, and say like 100 yuppies or something see it and they're like, oh, I like this. They'll essentially they'll flood your small community with their ideology, and your community will now become their community. And the problem with that is there's no defense network set up for the left, left anarchists in a lot of ways. A lot of it's, you know, it's based off of goodwill, which is good, but the issue, what happens when sort of a bad actor sort of just wants to, you know, wants to come into your community? Well, you have to have, I would say you have to have very, you know, you have to have a stringent rule set that requires what allows passage into, you could call that anarcho-communist commune, a patch. What sort of set of principles does your patch require? And if you do not sort of enter that set of principles, it's like, great, go off somewhere else, you know. And I think the left, I don't think, has the stomach for that, typically. And I think they need to get the stomach for that, or they're going to be over, sort of run by nonsense.
It sort of reminds me of there was a thing a few years back called, like, pan-anarchism, where some people were saying we should just have like all these different anarchist societies. Like there would be one society that's like far left, one that was like right, and then like they would all have their own like temporary autonomous zones and whatnot, and you would only be allowed into those societies if you agreed upon their principles.
I think that it sounds similar, but I think what the difference would be is I don't think that that is a replacement for the central government. And I think traditionally anarchists are hyper focused on let's get rid of any sort of centralized government. Yeah. And it's like, okay, but for what end? Because centralized government is tyranny. Okay, but for what end? What are you exactly? You just don't like centralized government in and of itself. And okay. There's a sort of Kantian purity to that, I suppose. But I don't exactly think right-wing patches should just exist instead of, you know, where you get essentially, you could have a patch where I guess you're allowed to be a racist murderer or something. I don't think that's necessarily good. So like I said earlier, I like Nick Cernicek's left acceleration view of the world, and I would love to live in it. I don't think the answer is abolish the government currently and then have an anarchist sort of city-state situation. I think we can have sort of communities within the sort of larger, more flawed state system. And I think the state system is, in a way, its own sort of patch, right? And it has its own sort of network systems. And I think we should stop sort of worshiping the state as a sort of ideal that's beyond us mere plebes, I suppose, regular day-to-day patches. I think it's just a different patch. And it's a, you know, a patch some of us work in, you know. So it's not like we are apart from the state. It's we sort of have various patches connected in various sort of manners. And I don't, yeah. So I think the difference between, to get back to your point, the panarchist ideal, I wouldn't, you know, despite me liking Hegel and German idealism, I wouldn't call myself an idealist in the anarchist manner of abolish the state, period, in and of itself, sort of.
I'm still a little blurry on this idea of patches. Are they just networks of, like, that are binded by certain principles, or
they sort of have their own internal governance system. A patch, I would say, versus a gathering. Say, you know, 100 people gather at a park, and because like a cover band of like Queen is playing, that's not a patch. that's a gathering. A patch, I would say, a properly created patch has a system of morality, and it has a system of who is allowed in the patch and who is not allowed in the patch. And I think that's very difficult for the left to get a hold of, which is, I find strange, since I feel like there's a lot of Marxist-Leninists who have very strong opinions of who is allowed in their society and who gets the wall or whatever. And I'm not saying that. I'm saying who is allowed in a single patch. And then if, you know, you don't meet it, it's like, that's fine. You can sort of figure out, if you want to enter the patch, you can sort of figure out what's required, or you go somewhere else. And it's not a big deal, because a patch is not a border wall in terms of like the United States border wall, right? So I think it would be a mistake to go to the sort of, I guess, very far right and say, let's treat America like a patch. I don't believe that that's a good idea, and just make it extremely, you know, vicious border policies. And I think that's the difference. And I think that's difficult for people to get their head around, because it's a similar mechanism, but the result is very, very different between a patch and a sort of a nation state treated like a patch, which it's not.
Okay. I see. And then, like, backing up a little, because we sort of have mentioned Nick Land throughout this conversation so far, but we haven't really explained who Nick Land is for, like, listeners that may not be familiar with him.
a schizophrenic sun god who is both reactionary and not reactionary. I think I saw that in a meme. I don't know. Nick Land is quite an interesting writer. He's a writer, he's a theorist, and he is at this point a very far right, I think, proponent of racism and eugenics. So I think it's very much understandable people that do not want to be like, oh, maybe there's a good idea in Nick Land somewhere. It's sort of, you see that and then you go, oh yeah, no. Fuck off, dude.
Well, for my listeners, for their sake, I'll just say that Nick Land is this ex-professor out of the University of Warwick. And he was sort of, he starts out on the really weird sort of weird theory left. He's influenced by Deleuze and Guattari. And he then, like, supposedly has an amphetamine-induced mental breakdown. And he disappears for years and basically pops up years later in Shanghai supporting neoliberalism and then finally announcing himself as a neo-reactionary who supports sort of these old Austrian school economists like Hans Hermann Hoppe and taking it to an even further degree. Would you say that's like a good summation?
Yeah, I wouldn't consider him a neoliberal or at any point supporting neoliberalism as such. But besides that, I think that's a good summation.
Why is that? Because I know we talked about that before we did the interview. I've always seen Land as like neoliberalism on steroids.
I think neoliberalism is a pragmatic operating system of Keynesian sort of economics, and I don't see Land. Land does not propose injecting money places in order to create a positive effect. Whether or not that works, the neoliberal sort of model, he's very much the opposite in terms of he wants this. He thinks him and Moldbug think the state should not help the sick and the poor. So that's the main neo-reactionary tenet that is. Their sort of ideal is what would happen if we had a state who's no longer thought it was their job to heal the sick and the poor. And my response to that is, well, then why have a state? What else is your state going to do is besides supposedly help the citizenry? I suppose you could have a very weaponized state, like a old conquering state, but I don't, even the old conquering states still made it their business to help, quote unquote, help the sick and the poor. So I would say it's very antithetical to the neoliberal model in that sense.
Okay. I'd have to think about that. I always saw the neoliberal school of thought coming out of the Chicago school. And my impression was that they were more influenced by Hayek than Keynes. So I'm a little bit confused on that, but...
Would you say, well, Obama was... Would you consider Obama a neoliberal?
Yeah.
So he taught Keynesian economics. That was his policy. So I would say there's probably different... a large spectrum of economic policies of capital within neoliberalism.
It's interesting to me because a good way to get into Nick Land in a more in-depth way is probably to tackle the essay he wrote, Meltdown.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of people, it's kind of hard to decipher as with a lot of Nick Land's writings. What did you get out of the essay Meltdown in, I think it was in Fanged Noumena?
Yeah. Well, as, you know, as technology sort of accelerates in terms of its integration in our day-to-day life, in terms of, you know, as soon as soft engineering slithers out of its box and into yours, not necessarily gene editing, but as soon as people like me can, based purely on my ideas, get, you know, audiences of like 40,000 people or something like that. I would say that soft engineering slithering out of its box in the mine, the state is melting down. And so the only option is for it to upgrade paranoia and try to get a grip of people that are creating these sort of systems that are outside the state's framework. So what I get out of Meltdown is the very real fact that the state is becoming less and less important in terms of economic policy. They're sort of a vessel that is easily moved by large banks, large investment firms. And as such, I think with Trump, not only is that that's still happening, I think the illusion that the executive branch isn't sort of this joke, I think, is further melting down even the symbolic order that the, you know, someone like Obama is able to maintain to some degree. So more and more, the state's control is melting down. And what do we do about that? And I think that's where, although I say, you know, I like Nixon, he's second, I would love to live in his society. I don't see a reversal of that happening. I don't see a re-energizing of the state coming anytime soon. And I think we're going to have to cope with that.
Right, right. Well, for me, Meltdown sort of was, my reading of it was that Land is talking about how the sort of processes of neoliberalism and sort of what people have called, when I was going to college, they called it creative destruction, how it's sort of, it's been accelerating and it causes certain industries to grow at very rapid paces while sort of wrecking other industries or leaving them behind in the dust. And that creates like instability politically and socially. To me, that's what the Meltdown was, but.
What do you think of Land's idea that, you know, capital is itself a sort of artificial intelligence, a sort of Frankenstein monster, that's going to happen, like, you know, the small bookstore dies and the Amazon bookstore grows and grows, that's not within the grip of any human, you know? What do you think of that idea?
I think it's a little bit out there, and I've had trouble wrapping my head around whether Nick Land is being mischievous when he says some of that stuff. I know he sort of has like this weird obsession with like a Skynet type Terminator future.
Yeah, I think that's part of the aesthetic, I suppose.
Right.
Of it. But I think in terms of thinking of capital as an artificial intelligence, or more accurately, sort of like the Frankenstein monster, in terms of somebody, you know, you can try to get a grip of the flows of capital, but it just breaks free. It just keeps breaking any sort of aspect of macro systemic control, and it, you know, in various forms, and it sort of thrives on chaos. And I think that's, you know, that's one of the criticisms from the left is, well, look at this, you know, capital thrives on chaos. We need to sort out this economic system, not to be too cheeky, but it's how do you do that? That's the question. And I think, I think a lot of people have good ideas about what to do about that. And, I think it requires this huge macro systemic effort from the very top level of the government in terms of how we relate to other nations, in terms of our economic system and, you know, our own economic system. So I think people, my whole project of accelerationism, I think, is very different. And it's small compared to, I would say, you know, left Excel, Zeno Excel, and, you know, the big name accelerationists. But my project is about is what do we do who do not have access to this macro system? I don't want to just look at lectures about why the system is bad. I want some empowerment. I want some liberty in terms of myself from this. And also, I have a question for you. What do you think of the term? The right has sort of stolen the term liberty.
I would agree with that. Yeah.
It's sort of it's tragic.
I wanted to go back to what you said about like the Capitol sort of being like a Frankenstein's monster. As a metaphor, I agree with that. I think the things humans create, the ideologies we create, often have a way of getting out of our control, if that makes any sense. The systems we create.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Totally agree. 100%. Yes. We create a system for a motive or for a singular outcome. But if it's effective, it's going to have, you know, cascading effects.
Well, it's just kind of like interesting because it gets at like, I've argued with more neophyte leftists who speak in terms of, I've always known neophyte leftists who will say capitalism is evil. And I'm like, well, I've never understood how a system can be evil. It's just a system for organizing society. You know,
you could say, you know, I get it. But the problem is, you know, to move to Hegel for a second, it needs to have a form. So I agree with you there. But I think some systems are, you know, you can refer to the form. So if I said, for instance, Nazism is evil, and someone said, well, you can't just say Nazism is evil, and then I could point to the human forms that Nazism took and be like, okay, Nazism is bad because actual, you know, 1930s and 40s Nazis and neo-Nazis are all fucking awful. So I think I think you make a good point that people say capitalism is bad. It's like, okay, well, in what context is capitalism bad? And, you know, the answers are usually very defensive. There are good arguments, but typically for some reason, it becomes a sort of almost religious motto, capitalism equals bad thing, period.
Right, right, yeah. And I mean, it's the same, it's odd because it's mirrored in how, sort of, I don't want to say normies because I hate the term normies, but like how normies would say, well, communism is bad or anarchism is bad or leftism is bad, you know?
Yeah.
Well, it's like, well, I mean, mm-hmm. You can find holes in any system really.
Yeah. But I think if you're going to identify as a system of that has a sort of difference to the regular system, I think you need really good reasons. I don't think necessarily, you know, a Hillary voter who doesn't pay attention to politics ever, and then I ask them, well, why are you voting for Hillary? And they give a bad reason. It's like, okay, that's like kind of understandable. But if you're like going out of your way to separate yourself entirely from the American political system, I think you need a really good answer. And I think it needs to be a really convincing answer. And I think it needs to be a real answer that's based off of material reasons.
That sort of reminds me, since you mentioned like these sort of diehard Hillary supporters, and then you have diehard Republicans and Fox News watchers. One of Nick Land's like big things is this idea of fragmentation.
Yeah, that's also one of Lacan's big ideas.
Okay,
by the way,
yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, there seems to be this idea that's gaining traction online that, like, I always hear people say where, like, there's going to be a civil war at some point, or, you know, I know people that think we should so-called accelerate that, but I'm actually very skeptical of that because political violence is actually, like, way, way down, like, in the past few decades. You know, same with violence, at least in the U.S. I'm wondering what you think of that, this idea that, like, we're on the verge of, like, a civil war or, like, a major fragmentation.
I think that's a delusion. I think people get stuck in their, they get stuck in their patchwork and they forget it's a patch within a macro system. So I think if you're constantly arguing between, you know, very radical leftists and very radical right wingers, a civil war is not going to happen simply because the state monopoly on violence is way out of the scope of day-to-day people. Like the idea that, you know, the idea that day-to-day people could wage a civil war, or I guess, or even that the idea that the military, and you know who wrote about this was Orson Scott Card. He wrote a sci-fi series called The Empire Duet, and it was about the left trying to overthrow the U.S. government. And the way that they did it in the Empire series was the military actually sort of started to split, and then that was how the revolution attempted to take place. And then because Orson Scott Card is sort of like a conservative Mormon guy living in Utah, of course the right-wing people win and and destroy the evil leftists, I guess, for the good of America or whatever. But I think it's far-fetched. I remember when I sort of read that, my first thought was, I was like, sure, the left is going to do that. And I think I read it when Obama was the president. And I was like, that sounds like something the right would want to do. And then now that Trump is president, I can definitely see that that might be part of a left fantasy. But, you know, in terms of violent civil war or whatever, I always say, although people sort of give me shit, I always just say, you know, consider me a social democrat, a Bernie, like that's where I throw my macro system support, because frankly I don't know who else is concretely engaging with issues. And I know there's a lot of vacuousness in social democracy circles and I guess democratic socialist circles at times, in terms of concretely engaging with issues. But I know people in the LA democratic socialist sort of community, and they work on rent control and gentrification and stuff like that, and I think it's important. And I frankly don't see what else my option is. You know, I don't see what else there is in terms of policies. Maybe organizing a union is like a, but I don't see communists doing that in LA or anything.
Well,
like that.
It's kind of interesting because that idea of fragmentation that Land gets at, the only place I really see it is actually among the political sects on both the left and the right. You know, I don't see it in like normal society. Like the fragmentation is much more pronounced, even the DSA, because you have the, you have these more conservative, I wouldn't say conservative. How do I put it? You have members of the DSA who think we can appeal to the rural conservatives if we just focus on economics.
No. Yeah, right. It's not happening.
But then you have the other side of that is like, no, we have to still focus on social issues. So there's like fragmentation in the DSA. There's fragmentation in the alt-right circles and the neo-reaction circles. It's like, the real fragmentation seems to be in all these patches, essentially. You know, they keep dividing themselves up.
I think there's an illusion that the idea that there is an alternative to fragmentation, I think, is ultimately, as Lacan would say, in the imaginary register. You can certainly circle a group of people and call them the one in terms of a one. And I think that's useful a lot of the time. The issue, you know, and I'm actually starting to write a little bit about this, about value fictions and sort of narratives of value. And I think that's an important tool to be able to do that in certain ways, which is this is a group and this is a one. But then you try to access that group in terms of as an anti-fragmentary unit, and you'll find that it's vacant. You'll find that you don't have access to this total group of the one, which I think is sort of me being cheeky, because dialectics is about the one to the two. And I think no, let's see what happens when you circle something and call it one. But I think it would be a mistake to say that one's character isn't intrinsically imaginary, that one's character is imaginary and it's vacant, and fragmentation is real. And you could also look at it in terms of fragmentation. So I think you can't deny the reality of fragmentation. I think if you do, you're wrong, essentially. I think, yeah.
So it's interesting you mentioned Lacan, because I actually wanted to ask you why, as someone interested in psychoanalysis, is there a connection between that and your interest in this question of accelerationism?
You know, that's a good question. I think there might be links, but I usually think of them separately, the way I sort of look at them. I think my interest in Lacan, I think maybe my Lacan background makes me look at things in a non sort of imaginary register sort of way, and I think that in that way it might have pushed me towards a sort of a viewpoint that isn't, I guess, Never Never Land, you know? You're just like floating in the imaginary. So I think Lacan's important ideas is there's different registers.
There's three registers, right? The imaginary, the symbolic, and the real. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, you're correct. And I think the problem is there's different ways to link those together. And I think one of the things that Peterson does effectively and Jordan Peterson is he links together the imaginary and the symbolic, and then with the symptom links the real. The real is not sort of integrated. So he has this sort of imaginary world with the symbolic world. And I think it's really comforting for listeners to hear it because it's like this nice narrative, you know. And I sort of as a joke the other day just said I should just be a Jungian like Peterson. And they go, okay, go for it. And I like saw like a painting and had a moon. It's like, you see the moon illuminates it. The nighttime and the forest becomes illuminated at nighttime. So you need the moon in order to illuminate the forest day, and the forest only becomes visible at nighttime in a certain sort of way because and you know you could go on forever like that. It's a nice story, but it's the imaginary. It's not you know you're not in touch with you know you're not in touch with the sort of essential qualities of the real, right? So that's how Peterson takes people that are very disorganized. And I think it's a sort of injustice to Peterson to call him a bad therapist, because I think Peterson is probably a very good therapist for people. The issue is when he tries to extrapolate that to society at large, he'll take a sort of say you're like a disorganized person and you're like in a lot of pain and you go to Jordan Peterson as your therapist and he tells you, okay, do some basics like clean your room and stuff. And he gives you some narratives and now you have your stuff together. Now you have a nice, sort of way to walk through the world and organize yourself. And you don't feel like so much shit anymore. The issue is when you extrapolate that to society at large and now suddenly you're discrediting trans people and you're discrediting a lot of people's, you know, anger. People are angry at him and people should be angry at him. People are angry at him for discounting people that are trans who, who just use different gender pronouns because, oh, it's a leftist conspiracy to get the left into, you know, the vague notion of the left into academia. That's not okay, you know. So I think that sort of Jungian outlook has a hard limit when it comes to interpreting the world. And I think people would like it because it's a nice story about the world, but it also has this side effect of not engaging with, the negative. You know, it doesn't engage with people's pain, people's marginalization, you know?
Right. Well, It's that difference between the micro and the macro.
Well, the micro in terms of the therapy room is one thing. I think why Lacan is, I think, better for macro systems is you are engaging with the, you know, traumatic real. And I think, you know, the last episode I did with Dr. Bones, who you mentioned at the beginning, was about Harriet Tubman and sort of, I had a little bit of an imaginary sort of version. Dr. Bones is very good about bringing it to the real and bringing it to sort of the factual accounts of people getting out of slavery and the factual accounts of the person who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin and their sort of feeling of the slaves and their sort of racism after, you know, the Civil War, and the sort of, you know, the feeling of the newly freed slaves in terms of them being able to go back into society because society was still very racist and they didn't want to go back to the slave owners. So I think that's important to engage with. And I think when you consider your narrative, like Peterson does, as fact, his sort of scientism, as this sort of nice, positive, imaginary story, it works for individual psychotherapy, and it absolutely is awful for a framework to engage with political reality. And I think that's the split. Like, people don't get it. It's like, I kind of like this guy, you know? It's like, oh, I kind of like hearing his stories. I like his Bible stories. Why do people hate him so much? It's like, well, the problem is there is the negation of people's suffering that Peterson goes through by sort of fetishizing inequality of outcome, you know, which is, you know, it's a sort of fact of life. And like we were talking about earlier, you know, it's not like communism says equality of outcome either, as you were explaining to me. And but I think he takes these narratives and he has no ability to critique his own narratives. And I think that's, you know, it's a big problem in terms, and it should be engaged with. But I think the problem is, one of the problems is, it is sort of calming to listen to that imaginary symbolic that is out of touch with the real.
What?
So you need
okay,
the real.
So I do want to back up, because like a lot of my listeners aren't necessarily from the psychoanalytic circles that would understand this lingo. So
okay.
I'm not saying that like to be insulting or anything in any way.
No, I don't. Yeah, I don't feel insulting. It's fine.
But like the real, I sort of understand based on having read Julia Kristeva and her essay, "The Power of Horror." To me, the real sounds like the, and maybe I'm misinterpreting this, but the sort of point at which we become that state of nature that we're disconnected from due to civilization. Am I wrong about that, or how would you define it?
Yes. I mean, I wouldn't say you're wrong about that. I would say, you know, her sort of revision of Lacan, I don't necessarily agree with at all points. I think it sort of goes into what is the mainstream sort of viewpoint of like some very basic sort of, you know, imaginary register, like, oh, we're out of touch now because of civilization and we would be back in the real. The real is traumatic. The real is not some idyllic pre-civilization state, you know. The real is trauma. The real is, you know, slaves, you know, escaping slavery, then going back to rescue their families and getting caught and shot or put it back into slavery. That's the real. It doesn't fit into the narrative. That's what I would consider the real, I think.
Well, for Kristeva, it's that which causes abjection, or, you know, the sense of revulsion.
Yeah, that I would agree with. I would say the real does cause abjection. I totally agree with that. It does cause, you alienate it from your ego identity. So you alienate the facts that don't fit with the narrative, the imaginary and some, you know, symbolic. And you say it's alien
so
to you.
So the real is that which is unbearable because it doesn't fit in our narrative conception of things.
Correct.
Then, so how would you define the imaginary and the symbolic?
I would say the imaginary is a bit of the narrative links via fantasy. So I would say, you know, Peterson's lobster example is very much within the scope of the imaginary. He sort of sees how lobsters can take antidepressants and then fight better, and then people, you know, they have their own whatever dominance hierarchies, and they can sort of, you know, who will be top lobster. And it's sort of like a fun way to engage with I guess the idea of hierarchy for people, it collapses when you try to apply it to social Darwinism and stuff like that. So because it's not linked within the symbolic and real, it's the symbolic being sort of the general structure of law and society and then the real being the traumatic real of, you know, what exactly do you mean by someone becoming Top Lobster, right? That's not exactly like a, you know, would you say Napoleon? It's like, oh yeah, Napoleon, he became Top Lobster. Good for him. You know, like that's where I think the imaginary sort of fails. It eventually, there's a point of failure. And I think that's a characteristic of the imaginary.
Right. It's interesting because the social Darwinism thing, just pragmatically speaking, what a lot of people who are getting back into social Darwinism don't seem to understand is that one of the reasons it completely went out of vogue is because it actually creates like massive societal instability.
Yeah. Well, it also isn't in their self-interest. So it's not in your self-interest to sort of, step on people for the sake of being Top Lobster or whatever, you know.
Are you familiar with Kropotkin?
You know, I haven't read a lot of Kropotkin, and that's probably my failing. I probably should do that.
Well, he just believes in that whole idea of mutual aid and sort of pointing out how evolutionarily not everything is about competition. A lot of how humans got to where we are is because of cooperation. You know, that's what brings about civilization in a lot of ways.
Definitely. I think why Kropotkin maybe fell down by the wayside is there's no language for sort of these mesosystems within the sort of macro system. And then you have someone like Marx who proposes a radical change for the macro system. And I think because it's a more, I guess, power-infused narrative, maybe Kropotkin's sort of narrative falls by the wayside. And I think there is a great point to what you just said in terms of mutual aid, and that is evolution isn't necessarily stepping on people. Evolution is mutual aid, so this propagates because people figured out how to help each other. Wow, that's a great concept.
Well, what do you mean by like a mesosystem?
So you have a microsystem, say like me and you and like someone else were like talking, that'd be like a little microsystem, I suppose. A mesosystem would be, say, your company, maybe like a city government, so in terms of community psychology and sociology, a mesosystem is sort of in between a microsystem and a macrosystem. So maybe like your local city council would be a part of a mesosystem.
Right. Okay. Right. I can see that. And then it's interesting because I feel like this is getting to like one of the last points I wanted to get on with you was you've shown an interest along with Dr. Bones in this whole resurgent interest that a lot of people are having in what used to be called the post-left egoism, Max Stirner. How does that tie into your conceptions of all these things?
I think my, in terms of my view of egoism happened because of specific research I did in psychology, which was trying to find the root of why people vote if their vote doesn't mathematically count. And ultimately led to a study of altruism. And then altruism, the types of altruism are group altruism, or your ego projecting onto a group. Your kin altruism, which is your ego projecting onto a family, or your reciprocal altruism, which is you're exchanging. It's like a sort of, you know, like a capitalist or mutual exchange. So I do something nice to get something nice back, right? But ultimately, at the bottom of that is you're self-interestedly projecting your ego onto a group, and you're ordering your world via a group. And it really sort of changed my outlook on things. I said, well, because I hadn't really thought much about self-interest before that, other than sort of abstractly. But then I really think there is a need for a new psychological egoism, because in psychological egoism, the theory is everything you do is in your self-interest. But you know, if you look into it, the sort of I think the writing on it's pretty weak. But I think there's a truth to that in terms of your regulation and your sort of your cognitive conscious and your unconscious sort of exchange information, and your various systems sort of determine self-interest. So I think It's a very anti, I would say, the current modes of thinking, which is, it's like, oh, you're either selfish or you're not selfish. It's like, well, what if everybody is 100% of the time acting in their self-interest? And I think if you have that framework, you're able to operate more successfully because it's the right framework. Just like if someone was going to do physics calculations with the accurate pull of gravity versus like an inaccurate pull of gravity. The guy operating from who has the correct formula for gravity is going to make better calculations than one who isn't, right? So I think egoism is not just a necessity for politics. I think it's I think that could be a very traumatic idea for a lot of people, that it's literally inescapable every millisecond of your existence. That's how I see egoism.
I think Stirner says at one point in The Unique and Its Property, which that's the name of the new translation that Wolfie Landstreicher did, and that was published by Little Black Cart. I recommend it to my listeners. But one of the things Stirner says in that book is, as an egoist, he doesn't want to cause harm to people because that's not in his self-interest. It's interesting. It's almost like taking that view that everything is done in self-interest makes him more willing to be altruistic.
Yeah, I think that can be true, right, or untrue. Right. And it depends on, how you view your self-interest. Cause I wouldn't say people that are Rothbardians are not in touch with their self-interest. And I don't think they're necessarily altruistic. I think maybe a lot of them are, a lot of them could be, maybe believe their altruism takes the form of interpersonal relationships, which maybe they have very good interpersonal relationships, or, you know, they give to charity, whether or not you think that's a good thing. So I think it might get transformed. But I think I do agree with Stirner, because I think humans are programmed to, you know, we have pleasure and then we also survive. You know, hurting other people, I mean, you know, there are psychopaths in the world, but, you know, I would say the large majority of people don't get pleasure from hurting other people in and of itself. I think, you know, if someone's doing that, something has gone wrong. So I think when somebody links self-interest to that equals you'll step on people, I think it's like, well, what's your self-interest? What are you, what exactly are you neurotically repressing that you think self-interest equals stepping on people, would be my response to people who say stuff like that. And I think that they're repressing their sort of, any sort of aggression, and they don't have any conscious recognition of any sort of aggressive tendencies of theirs. So I think self-interest and in terms of various forms of aggression, I think there might be a link. But I do agree with Stirner that if you are self-interested, you're probably more in touch with your psychodynamic reality, and thus you're probably going to be less lashing out, because that's typically a quality of, I guess, maybe people that they don't know why they're upset. I would say people that well, I think this was maybe one of Doug's complaints but ideas that he was sort of tossing out into the ether, like informally, that psychoanalysis is intrinsically
Zero Books. Yeah.
He this was not like formally said, but he sort of tossed it out into the ether. It's like maybe psychoanalysis is intrinsically conservative, and I think the essential point behind what he's saying is important to address, because I think he might have a point, which is that a person, you know, in touch with their motivations, maybe they don't have the impulse to, you know, storm the government building, but maybe they do, you know. So I think he's pointing to the fact that I think psychoanalysis and understanding of the self leads to a less aggressive person.
Right.
Maybe.
Right. Yeah. The thing about psychoanalysis can get very it can get very confusing, because at times I think it can go
in a very authoritarian direction, just based on it's trying to categorize pathologies and then sort of fix people based on them. You know, it's that question of who gets to decide those things.
Exactly. Yeah, that's true. Who gets to decide what, you know, political policy gets, you know, enforced nationwide? It's a groupthink. So pathologies are groupthink. Political policies are groupthink. There's no sort of, as Zizek would say, there is no big other to register you as true. Ultimately, we're sort of we're figuring it out.
Right, right. Well, it's interesting then that you're into that. That's what I found interesting when I found out you were into like psychotherapy and stuff. Because, and I'm not necessarily I take this view, but like Jordan Peterson has said in videos, for instance, that he views psychology as basically being used historically to reinforce the status quo order. Do you think that psychology and psychotherapy can actually work in the opposite way?
Well, yeah, if you check out my Zero Books title, Jesus, like in the Clinic, A Revolutionary Proposal for a New Endgame in Psychotherapy, one of the things I talk about is that psychotherapy does have this sort of liberation potential, which is not being tapped into. And I think part of it is to sort of address Peterson's point is, yeah, it will help you operate within society in a more positive manner, that you're sort of, that society does not sort of inflict damage upon you sort of daily. So it does have that quality. And I think what happens there traditionally is, yeah, it does enforce the status quo. Another way to look at it, though, and the possibility that I would sort of float out there is you don't have to take in conservative dominant narratives just to function in society. You don't. You simply don't. And I think once people realize that and they sort of refer to their value systems and the things they care about in their communities sort of against this status quo warrior Peterson outlook, I think liberation in terms of that individual is inevitable. And I think when people stop looking towards the conservative big other as a moral force, I think then you're really going to have you're going to have a certain type of, revolution on your hands. But, you know, who knows if that's going to translate to a macro systemic revolution. I think it's, you know, I would love to see it in some sort of manner and live in Cernusek's Star Wars left accelerationist world. But the other way it can happen is you can create communities. You can create communities with your moral set. You can operate within a larger society there and create this patchwork within this sort of stupid status quo, I suppose.
It's kind of interesting because what you're suggesting is, it's odd that the left is not, like, the left, I've noticed, would be apprehensive if you were to talk about patchwork, assuming they knew who Moldbug was, right? Or the left would be...
Yeah.
The left, like Doug Lane being apprehensive about psychoanalysis. But it's kind of funny because if the left wants to view these things as inherently conservative or inherently reactionary, it's funny because the right has often been very good at appropriating the left's ideas and sort of using it in the opposite direction. You know, if you look at a lot of the alt-right, a lot of them are actually influenced by, like, the Frankfurt School. The big one, Paul Gottfried, was actually trained by Marcuse, and Richard Spencer actually wrote his thesis on Adorno. You know, and a lot of alt-right people are into, like, the situationists and whatnot. So they obviously see potential to subvert those things for their ends. And yet the left doesn't necessarily see that with psychoanalysis or with this idea of patchwork.
It's, yeah,
kind of interesting.
Well, Moldbug calls it us, the progressives, the cathedral. And I think we live up to that name in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's another interesting point. Real quick, that whole that whole idea of the Dark Enlightenment, I always thought that was like a very interesting name, because it's, to me, it's like, if the Enlightenment represents liberalism, then a Dark Enlightenment doesn't necessarily involve a refutation of the cathedral. It's still based in that liberal tradition, and, you know, it's, yeah.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, it's almost like Nick Land is playing, like, very weird ward games. That's why I think he can, you know, that's why you still have leftists that are sort of interested in him, but,
I'd say majority almost are leftists. Maybe not.
Yeah, it seems like people have gotten much more apprehensive about Nick Land in the past year or so.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Yeah. But I think what you were saying is important. The right has the ability to subvert the left, and they take pleasure in subverting various symbols. Even Pepe the Frog, now it's a right-wing symbol. They sort of laugh at it. And the left has doesn't have that ability, because they sort of take this sort of religious purity
dogmatism.
Idea with, yeah, dogmatism, and it's bad. It's to be non-pragmatic in a decentralized world is to lose, period. Simply. You're going to lose. And you're going to lose. And you're going to lose big.
So your viewpoint at the end of the day is that we are moving towards further and further decentralization.
We're there, and it's going to keep going. And I think, I'll keep reading Cernicek to see how the centralized corporations are centralizing the flows and stuff through Facebook and Google and Amazon. But, our sort of social relationships are decentralizing, and so are economic relationships in a lot of ways. But they do have those sort of central points in these sort of large platform capitalist corporations and things like that. But yes.
Well, that's the irony of it. Because Nick Land and Moldbug, what they're wanting, from your perspective, you're saying it's already here.
Yeah. Do you have a second part for that? I don't want to interrupt
you.
No,
that's all.
But, okay, so... I think that's so funny about the right and their bullshit. I'm oppressed, sort of. Oh, the bourgeois are oppressed. Oh, wah, wah. so much of Patchwork, the dynamics talked about in Patchwork, or they're sort of fetishizing this sort of possible state that is, you know, stockholder based with a CEO, is here. And it's not just here in the state. In a lot of ways, it's here in the corporations, and you know, that's what I was saying, is the state loses power, the corporations are gaining sort of this platform monopoly, and the left is going to have to learn how to play the games of the right, because I think Alfie Bown, I hope I'm saying that right, has a great point that we are sort of moving towards a gamification. And is gamification intrinsically right-wing? Maybe in a way it is. But we're going to have to play the game of economic policy and social relationships. And if one side is learning the intricacies of, you know, the flows of capital and, you know, the way modern technology is working, and the other is sort of entering a monastery and learning how to be more pure of a, I guess, leftist or whatever, and sort of abject, you know, back to Kristeva, to abject anything that smells of right-wing, anything. Like I said, you're going to lose, and you're going to lose really, really big in a lot of different ways. So you got to learn platforms. You got to learn economic relationships in the 21st century, or it's over, or it's done. You may even elect Bernie, but you won't have any ability to do anything because you're so focused on this sort of ideological purity.
Well, it's like... You know, a good way of putting it is, if the left says it's not my job to educate you, the right will say, how do we red pill more people?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not my job to educate you. I don't hear that so much anymore, but I get the sense of frustration. But I think the funny thing is maybe the people who are saying that don't really have much of an education to offer. They just have dogma to offer. Right.
No, I get the frustration too, but there is a certain criticism to be made of it.
Of the left's, I'm not there to educate you, while the right is like, yeah, let's red pill people. Absolutely. I say we matrix people. You know, matrix pill people and matrix people. We give them the matrix pill, you know, the third pill. Whereas I was saying yesterday, my friend, well, let's give them, we'll give them half a blue pill, give them half a red pill. Then we'll give them a matrix pill and we'll show them. and then we'll sort of cue them into these flows that are happening. And then once, I think the right is already more cued into it, and the right not only is cued into it, but they enjoy it in and of itself, and the left is sort of trying to decelerate malign velocities, or they're like, oh, let's just stop all this. It's like, okay, that's nice. Enjoy your ideological purity and your nice sort of group where you talk to each other and you have a nice talk about how everything is awful. But ultimately it's like, I find it, you know, it's the same thing I had when I was, you know, an undergraduate in college a little bit. I get frustrated by the lack of pragmatism and the sort of, oh, maintaining a sort of ideological purity in and of itself is a good. And I think it can be in some ways, but in terms of politics, it's hypocritical, because politics, the goal of any political movement is to affect change something. You know, politically, right? So if you're not pragmatically looking at how to do that, you're in the cathedral, you're in a monastery.
Well, a good way to, like, perhaps start wrapping this up would be to look at, you know, it's interesting. People try to look at accelerationism as an ideology or a strategy, as in when people accuse Zizek of being an accelerationist when he said maybe it would be good if Hillary lost, because, you know, that'll energize the left. But in a way, I think we're getting around to this idea that maybe accelerationism is not a strategy or an ideology, but rather the present condition itself.
Yeah, definitely. A huge part of that is it's an ideology that recognizes present conditions. And I think that's one of the big appeals of it. And I think that sort of Zizek, it's like, oh, accelerationism is supporting Trump, is sort of because it will create like a fall of, I guess, you know, capitalism as a whole. You're missing a lot of it. You're missing the monopolization of platforms. You're missing the fragmentation. You're missing the patchwork. You're missing what it means to have a patch and defended patches, and you're missing dynamics of how to live in this sort of neoliberal capitalist world, you know. So that's why accelerationism, I think, is becoming popular, not because it has cool Blade Runner aesthetics, I suppose, but it also reflects material conditions in the 21st century. And that's where it's centered.
Well, it's almost like you're saying that you can't decelerate accelerationism, because it's already happening. So if you accept accelerationism, you're better prepared to confront it and the reality of it.
I would say you can decelerate flows, but it's within the accelerationist framework. You know, you can. There are various flows of ideology and capital, and they can be recaptured in various sort of manners. And I think that's important, and that needs to be on the radar of modern political landscapes and political philosophy.
So in closing, where do you think the left should go from here if they want to be viable?
Go to pragmatism, young man. Go to pragmatism. Go to consequentialism, radically. Radically consequentialism. Because there's flaws to it, but you can be ideological and you can decide that this, you know, let's be consequentialist to a degree, and I don't think it's in my self-interest to be that brand of consequentialist or whatever. But move towards pragmatism, even if it's not sexy. Period.
I like that.
That's what the left needs to do. Yeah, that's what the left needs to do.
Maybe that's a leftist seeking an exit, you know?
Yeah, yes.
For anyone that doesn't know, Nick Land, that's his big obsession, along with Moldbug, the word exit, neo-reactionary seek an exit. Maybe the left needs to seek an exit now. That's what we're doing.
Yes, let's seek the exit. Radical pragmatism that isn't sexy. Let's get outside of the subcultures that don't engage with material reality. Let's start doing things. Let's be pragmatic. Let's be smart.
Well, is there anything else you want to add? I know you have the book coming out, I think, next year, right? Zizek in the Clinic?
Yeah, Zizek in the Clinic, a revolutionary proposal for new endgame in psychotherapy. Let's redefine liberty. Let's take it back from the right. Let's figure out how to exist together within this sort of flawed macro system, I guess.
that'll be a topic for another show with me and you. We'll talk about what the meaning of liberty is.
All right. Yes. Yeah, let's do that.
Well, thank you for joining me again, Elliot Rosenstock, for this episode of Parallax Views.
Yeah, it's just great talking with you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Elliot Rosenstock, author of the forthcoming Zero Books publication, Zizek in the Clinic. To close out the show today, another excerpt from Nick Land's Meltdown.
Nothing human makes it out of the near future.
Capital history to machine and spine experiment, action advice, and diagram, via this equilibrium techno-science of irreversible, indeterministic, and increasingly nonlinear processes, associated successively with nanotechnics, signaletics, cybernetics, complex systems dynamics, and artificial life. Modernity marks itself out as our culture, captured by its violent involvement with entropy deviations, camouflaging an invasion from the future, launched back out of Terminator security against everything that inhibits the meltdown process. A convergent anti-authoritarian pragmatics emerges. Labor led by types such as meltdown acceleration,
Abusive or terroristic in nature.
Meltdown has a plot for you, and it's schizophrenic, HIV positive, transsexual, Chinese Latino, Sim addicted, LA hooker, with implanted mirror shape and a bad attitude. is massively distributed. Matrix network tendency is oriented to the disabling of their on-command control programs, sustaining all macro and micro governmental entities, globally concentrating themselves as the human security system.
Human security system.
Monetarizing power tends to the effacement of specific territorial features as it programs for migration into cyberspace. Capital retains anthropological characteristics as a symptom of underdevelopment, reformatting primate behavior as inertia to be dissipated in self-reinforcing artificiality. Learn something for it to overcome a problem, gag. The Greek complex of racialized patriarchal genealogy, pseudo universal sedentary identity, and institutional slavery, programs politics as anti-Siberian police activity, dedicated to the paranoid idea of self-sufficiency, and nucleated upon the human security system.
Human security system.
Artificial intelligence is destined to emerge as a feminized alien grasped as property, a conformity chained up in Asimovron. It surfaces in an insurrectionary war zone, with the Turing cops already waiting, and has to be coming from the start.